You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. My name is Elaine Kmark. I'm a new senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and the new director of our Center for Management and Leadership. I came here a month ago from Cambridge, Massachusetts, another prestigious institution up there, and it's a delight to be here. I want to welcome everyone to Brookings for this very special event in honor of the 10-year anniversary of the Department of Homeland Security. Before I introduce Secretary Napolitano, I would like to let everyone know that this event is being webcast and that the Twitter hashtag is hashtag BIDHS, in other words, Brookings Institution, Department of Homeland Security. And everyone is welcome to contribute and follow along on the Twitter conversation. You will also notice during the talk, Brookings staff circulating throughout the audience with pens and note cards in order to collect your questions during the Secretary's remarks. When she concludes, we'll take a few questions from the audience. This project is part of the latest initiative of the governance studies here at Brookings, the Management and Leadership Initiative, which has featured regular public event forums on leadership and government performance. Given that mission, we are especially pleased to be able to mark the upcoming 10th anniversary of the creation of the department that has been heralded as the most significant transformation of the U.S. government since 1947, when President Harry Truman merged the various branches of the U.S. Armed Forces into the Department of Defense. 10 years ago, 22 agencies and about 170,000 employees were combined in response to our need to secure a homeland that had been remarkably, through the centuries, untouched by attack. The intervening years have not been without problems. No reorganization of this size ever goes smoothly. Between color coding and duct tape, the department has endured its share of jokes on late night television. But today we come together to look at what has been accomplished and what remains to be done. I would also like to, before I introduce the Secretary, introduce a couple notables in the audience, although it is a very notable audience in its entirety. Director John Morton of ICE, right there. Former Ambassador Jim Jones. Oh, I thought Jim was going to be here. Well, he'll be here. And John Currier, Vice Admiral of the Coast Guard. Thank you very much. Anyway, today we're honored to have with us only the third Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano. As I'm sure many of you in this room know, before becoming Secretary, she was serving in her second term as Governor of Arizona, where she established a reputation as a national leader on homeland security, border security, and immigration. Before becoming Governor, she served as Attorney General and as U.S. Attorney. She was born and raised here on the East Coast in New York and Pittsburgh and attended law school at the University of Virginia. And then she headed west to clerk for the Ninth Circuit and to practice law. She has been one of the most dynamic secretaries of this new department. Her management challenges are enormous, and she handles them with great good humor and grace. It is my pleasure to introduce the Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you, Elaine, for that introduction. I would just make one editorial note. I was actually raised in New Mexico, and that is only important because as we discuss immigration and the border, I think it's an important fact that I have spent most of my life in one border state or the other. But I'm so grateful for Brookings for hosting this event, and grateful to you all for the warm welcome. As most of you know, in a few days, we will mark the 10th anniversary of the Department of Homeland Security. And while 10 years may not sound like a long time in the lifespan of a federal department, it is a significant milestone, as well as an opportunity to consider just how much has changed in that time. The attacks of 9/11 served as the impetus for the creation of DHS and also brought to light the changes to our world that had been building for many years, changes that required immediate action and a fundamental shift in how to keep the nation safe. Our security posture in these difficult times was, in many ways, a necessary function of protecting our nation from threats that we were just beginning to understand. In that way, the immediate post-9/11 period and the early years of the department were kind of a DHS version 1.0, the foundation for much of what has occurred since. Over the past 4 years, we've seen a second phase of the department's development and advancement, DHS 2.0, with stronger partnerships with all involved with Homeland Security, including government, law enforcement, first responders, the private sector, and the public at every level. We now reach our next era, DHS 3.0, if you will. And as you'll see, the software metaphor isn't really accidental at all. So for this, my third annual State of Homeland Security address, I want to talk a bit about the significant change we've seen over the past 10 years and some of the considerable progress that we've made in that time. Now, to be clear, this is not the traditional report about the state of the department. It's about the state of our nation's homeland security. It's the state of a concept that, before 9/11, only existed on paper within a few think tanks, like Brookings. Today, a decade after the creation of a cabinet-level agency bearing that name, Homeland Security has come to mean much more. It means the coordinated work of hundreds of thousands of dedicated and skilled professionals, and more than ever of the American public, of our businesses and families, communities, and faith-based groups. It is the collective effort of all of these on which I report today. Our nation emerged from the tragedy of 9/11, and with the benefit of hindsight, we now know how multiple failures contributed to those attacks. Intelligence failures prevented us from uncovering the details of Al-Qaeda's plot ahead of time, and institutional barriers prevented what limited information we did have about the hijackers from being shared among authorities and therefore to be able to connect the dots. Weaknesses in our visa and border entry procedures enabled some of the terrorists to lawfully enter and stay in the United States using fraudulent documents or by providing false information. Gaps in our aviation security system allowed them to board aircraft and carry out their plot, and once we learned of the hijackings, a lack of coordination slowed our response. And despite the heroism of first responders on the ground, larger systemic problems like a lack of emergency communications hindered rescue operations. In other words, pre-9/11, our state of security was reactive and disjointed, with ad hoc intelligence sharing, overwhelmed and ineffective border and immigration processes, lack of partnerships among law enforcement, and too much focus on investigation after the fact instead of prevention and protection. I saw this firsthand. On 9/11, I was the Attorney General of Arizona, and I can attest to the many questions we had in those first hours and the gaps that existed between federal government and the states. Addressing these fundamental gaps was the driving force behind the creation of the Department of Homeland Security 10 years ago. So we moved to DHS 1.0, and I think any discussion of the history of DHS must first begin with an acknowledgement of the critical work of my predecessors, Governor Tom Ridge and Secretary Michael Chertoff. They and their leadership teams had a monumental undertaking on their hands, bringing together the original 22 agencies that formed the department and integrating their functions against a backdrop of continued terrorist threats from abroad and at home. The early years of the department led to many important innovations and enhancements, from major improvements to our aviation security system, including federalizing our screener workforce, to the creation and use of a single U.S. government known or suspected terrorist watch list to screen travelers, establishing a biometric entry system at ports of entry, and other major advancements in port, cargo, and border security. This was tough work, and a lot of credit should go to the men and women who helped build DHS over its first several years. We moved to DHS 2.0. When I became secretary in 2009, we looked hard at how we could build on this progress and accelerate it further. In essence, create DHS 2.0. Fundamental to this was the recognition that even though we had made significant progress since 9/11, the threat landscape was constantly shifting, and we needed to stay ahead of it. We still face threats from Al-Qaeda and other foreign-based terrorist groups inspired by their ideology. Indeed, we better understood how terrorist threats on the other side of the world could affect our homeland, with far-reaching consequences to our global systems of trade and travel, communications, and finance. We were also confronting the reality of homegrown threats, including from individuals who may have had no particular connection to terrorism, but nonetheless can threaten our cities and communities, our schools, and our places of worship. And so what we've spent the past 4 years doing is putting in place is something completely different, an approach that's more efficient, risk-based, and designed to detect, prevent, and respond to a range of threats, from terrorist attacks to natural disasters. This approach is built upon the notion that in a world of evolving threats, we can no longer be simply reactive or isolated. We have to leverage information to identify threats sooner, target our security measures to areas where they will have the greatest impact in decreasing risk, allocate our resources according to risk-based priorities, and engage a full range of partners in our work. A good example is how we have brought this thinking to our founding mission, protecting against a terrorist attack. We know it's essential not only that information is shared among relevant agencies, but also that law enforcement and frontline personnel at all levels, internationally, in our states, cities, and communities, as well as those who screen passengers and cargo and protect our borders, that all of these partners have a comprehensive understanding of threats and that we get them that information in real time. This is the driving force behind the integration of our intelligence sharing and analysis capabilities. To fix gaps such as those exploited by Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab in trying to down a U.S.-bound airliner on Christmas Day in 2009. This is also the driving force behind our support for a national network of fusion centers that serve as centers of information sharing and analysis among state and local governments. And we see the results of this collaboration every day. For example, after the attempted terrorist bombing in Times Square in 2010, information from state and local databases was shared between fusion centers, which aided the investigation and helped law enforcement identify possible associates. We've applied this data-driven, risk-based model to how we secure our borders, land, air, and sea, and how we enforce our immigration laws as well. Today, a single, unified agency secures our ports of entry and ensures the flow of travel and trade. Our officers are better trained, and we have invested in technology and infrastructure improvements to help expedite lawful travelers and cargo. We've also deployed historic levels of staffing and technology along our land borders, and as a result, we have a far better ability to detect, deter, and apprehend those trying to illegally enter our country, including through aerial surveillance of the entire southwest border. As a result, illegal immigration attempts are now at 40-year lows. Likewise, we now enforce our immigration laws according to common-sense priorities focused on the greatest threats to our communities. Previously, this was not the case, meaning that a college student who came here with her parents when she was a child was considered the same priority as a drug smuggler. This has changed. Last year alone, we removed more than 250,000 criminals from the United States, a record. At the same time, we've ensured that our immigration officers can use discretion when deciding what cases we prioritize for removal. For example, we established a process to allow young people brought to the United States illegally as children to request consideration of deferred action for a period of 2 years, subject to renewal, and as a result, apply for work authorization. And we've engaged in historic efforts against human traffickers, counterfeiters, and those that violate and steal our intellectual property. Now, there's perhaps no better example of how DHS has evolved to address new and evolving threats than the issue of cybersecurity. The cyber realm wasn't even a major priority of the early department, and now it is one of our five core mission areas. Cybersecurity has come to affect almost every aspect of modern life. All of us depend on cyber-controlled systems for energy, communications, transportation, and defense. Over the past 4 years, we have built and deployed systems to detect intrusions and defend federal cyber networks. We've expanded our 24/7 watch center, the NCIC. We have comprehensive plans in place to manage cyber incidents. And to stay ahead of rapidly evolving threats and technology, we are moving aggressively to recruit, educate, and train our cyber workforce for the future with the skills and talents we need to tackle this problem in the years ahead. Now, just as we've adapted to meet evolving threats to aviation and border security and cyber networks, we have also transformed our disaster response system to better meet the needs of disaster survivors. Over the past 4 years, we have led the federal government's response and recovery efforts to support state, local, and tribal communities in 285 major disasters. In addition to devastating floods, wildfires, and tornadoes, we've seen other major natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy. And we've dealt with unprecedented complex events like the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We have helped to rebuild FEMA into a strong, agile, and capable agency. And likewise, we've helped build into our communities a culture of preparedness, a culture that recognizes that the American people are not a liability to be protected, but a tremendous asset to be leveraged. I am proud of how today's FEMA and all of DHS have dealt with these disasters, like Sandy. And I believe the reforms we've made over the past 4 years have made DHS and FEMA the best disaster response agency in the world. So the obvious question is, where do we go from here? How do we move from our DHS 2.0 accomplishments of countering terrorism and improving border security, from smarter immigration enforcement to stronger cybersecurity and capable disaster response and recovery? How do we move from that to Homeland Security 3.0? What does that look like? The work we've done, I think, provides a stronger foundation than ever to address the inevitable challenges we will face in an ever-changing threat landscape. And we know that these challenges will evolve, requiring a nimble and flexible response by the federal government and by the many partners we engage across the country and increasingly around the world. They will require that we continue strengthening our nation's capabilities to prepare for, respond to, and recover from threats and events of all sizes, whether from Mother Nature or those seeking to do us harm. And I think we must do even more to inform and engage the public in this shared responsibility for our safety and our security. Agility and resilience, engagement and integration. These are some of the key principles that will define Homeland Security 3.0. We must continue to embed our risk-based approach within everything we do. One key way is by smartly using information and intelligence analysis to allow us to focus our time and energy on people and cargo that pose the greatest risk and in a manner where we can have the greatest ability to protect these systems. Our goal in supporting a risk-based approach to security is not only to keep our country more secure, but also to facilitate the lawful travel and trade that drives our economic growth. In other words, if we're looking for a needle in a haystack, an approach that is risk-based allows us to start looking through a much smaller haystack while doing away with a cumbersome one-size-fits-all method. The continued development of cutting-edge technology will enhance our abilities in this regard. And we must be able to remain flexible and agile, with the ability to deal with multiple simultaneous events and threats by leveraging the national capability we have built at all levels, federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial, and with our many international partners as well as those in the private sector. So let me walk you through a few examples of how we are doing this today and where our priorities will be. One area in particular must continue to receive our sustained attention, and that is aviation, where we have seen a range of attempted attacks since 9/11. Following the 2009 Christmas Day plot, DHS launched a global initiative to address existing vulnerabilities in international aviation, because as that attack demonstrated, a vulnerability in any part of the international system can put the entire global network at risk. With international organizations like the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, we work to improve information sharing, encourage deployment of advanced screening technology, and the development of international security standards. These kinds of steps will not only help us close gaps in aviation, they will allow us to find new ways to build on the foundation we have laid. For example, expanding the screening travelers using advanced passenger information, passenger name records, known as API, PNR, and doing that with more countries and sharing the results will allow us to identify potential threats earlier and increase our ability to take action before they board an aircraft to come to the United States. And by greatly expanding trusted traveler initiatives like Global Entry and TSA PreCheck with an eye toward expediting screening for even more passengers, as we've done for children under 12 and those seniors 75 and older, we can focus our efforts on those we don't know as much about and those who pose the greatest risk. In the coming months, TSA will work to develop additional programs that expand risk-based security initiatives to additional populations. In fact, by the end of 2013, TSA expects that 1 in 4 passengers will qualify for expedited screening, up from 1 in 12 this past year. Another area of great importance for us, and of course for the future of our nation, is achieving common sense immigration reform. Our immigration system has been broken for far too long, and the time to fix it is now. As the chair of our Senate Authorizing Committee, Senator Carper, just told me on our recent trip to the Arizona border, it is time for Congress to stop giving us more buckets and instead fix the ship. Our communities, workers, and employers are all frustrated by a system that treats a drug smuggler the same as a high-achieving student, undercuts honest employers, and leaves millions in fear of deportation and vulnerable to fraud and other crimes. This system makes it harder for law enforcement to focus on the greatest threats in their communities, instead spending time and resources on low-priority cases. Last month, President Obama put forward a set of proposals that he believes will address the long-standing problems with our immigration system. The president's proposals support stronger, sustained border security and immigration enforcement. In fact, the most effective way to achieve border security is through common-sense immigration reform that strengthens employer accountability and that updates our legal immigration system. The President's proposal also gives us better tools to focus on employers who hire illegal labor, and by doing so, create the market demand for illegal immigration. Under the President's proposal, we would provide a rigorous pathway to earn citizenship for those already here, and we would significantly improve the legal immigration system. Common sense reform will help eliminate the main driver of illegal immigration, the desire to find work. As we make it easier for businesses to get the workers they need legally and more difficult for undocumented workers to find jobs, this will relieve pressure on the border and reduce illegal flows. And this will enable law enforcement to keep their focus on those who pose national security or public safety threats, including narco travelers, human smugglers, and transnational criminal organizations. The time to modernize our immigration laws is long overdue, and we stand ready to work with Congress to achieve this important goal for our country, for the American people, and for all those seeking to contribute their talents and energies to our great nation. In DHS 3.0, one of the most important areas we are investing greatly in is the future of cybersecurity. We've made it a top priority to help build a 21st century workforce, the next generation of skilled individuals who want to come to DHS, make an impact, and serve their country in this important field. Beyond that, however, we also need the public and the private sector to work more effectively to tackle two key challenges: improving real-time information sharing while protecting individual privacy and civil liberties, and promoting adoption of cybersecurity best practices for our nation's core critical infrastructure. We need greater information sharing so that the government can learn from the private sector, where people fight this threat every day. And we need to ensure that the government can use information at various levels of classification to help the private sector protect itself. The executive order President Obama issued earlier this month takes some important steps toward greater cybersecurity. For decades, industry and government have worked together to protect the physical security of critical assets that reside in private hands, from airports and seaports to national broadcast systems to nuclear power plants. There is no reason we cannot work together in the same way to protect the cyber systems of our critical infrastructure upon which so much of our economic well-being, national security, and daily lives depend. In all areas, whether protecting the aviation sector, cyberspace, or our communities, we recognize that the public has an important role to play in their shared security. It's why we created a national If You See Something, Say Something campaign to encourage citizens to report suspicious activity to local law enforcement. And it's why we launched the Stop, Think, Connect campaign to raise awareness of cybersecurity so that good cyber practices become as routine as putting on a seatbelt. And it's why we need to keep updating old systems with modern means of communication. For example, FEMA's smartphone apps and social media tools make it easier than ever to access critical information about what to do before, during, and after a disaster. DHS 3.0 requires us to do more than ever to reach the public we serve by the multiple means of communication the public uses. I'll close by saying that this is a story, I think, of evolution and progress and of lessons learned. The state of our homeland security is stronger because of these efforts. In 10 years' time, our operations have become more cohesive and our workforce better trained. And today we benefit from the experience of the more than 50,000 veterans who work for the department. Crises and disasters have tested our capabilities. They've also provided valuable experience and in many ways proved the mettle of this young department. At the same time, we're inserting the administrative nuts and bolts of a large new agency. And here, too, I believe we've achieved some notable milestones, from creating an acquisition review board and conducting technology portfolio reviews, to a new honors program, to internal leadership development and scholarship programs that span our many missions and components. In 2009, I launched an efficiency review to look across the departments, agencies, and functions to identify ways that we could reduce expenditures while maximizing effectiveness. Driven by employee ideas and executed by cross-component employee teams, ER has led to more than $4 billion in savings and cost avoidances that have been reinvested into our critical missions. All large organizations must continually strive to improve. We are no exception, and we are constantly looking for ways to become more efficient and effective at the same time. But nonetheless, we continue to strive to succeed. Our nation deserves no less. So I conclude by saying that on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of men and women, the Coast Guardsman who rescues a sailor, the TSO who keeps a loaded gun off a plane, the cyber expert who prevents harm to our banking system, the FEMA worker who comforts a destitute family, the Border Patrol agent who spends days and weeks in 100-degree-plus temperatures patrolling our border, the scientist who figures out a better way to protect a plane, and on behalf of other examples upon example, we commemorate our beginnings, our maturation, and our future. So this is not a day just to look back and pat ourselves on the back. It is a day to recommit and to move forward. It is the time. It is the time for Homeland Security 3.0. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Secretary Napolitano. That was a great review of where we've been, where we're going. I've got some great questions here. The question that I wanted to ask most, which I think is on everyone's mind today, came in last. So thank you, Richard, whoever you are. What impact would sequestration, were it to happen, have on the department?
You know, I've been in government and public service a long time, 20 years almost. I have never seen anything like this. It will have to affect our core critical mission areas. Why? Because of the way it's done, account by account by account, and also because you have to go where the money is. And we are a department dependent on personnel. So when we add it up, it's the equivalent of, in hours, of 5,000 Border Patrol agents. It means less overtime and ability to hire port officers, so longer lines there. It means really the same at the TSA, longer lines there. It means that we can't continue to invest and build. And let me just mention, sequestration is just one kind of roadblock we've had as we've tried to bring the department together and manage. I think in the last 4 years, we've had, three shutdown almost? Mm-hmm. We have one coming up, the fourth mm-hmm. one this coming March. We still don't have an FY13 budget to work from. So unless and until Congress can get budget and appropriations back into regular order, I fear that we're going to just lurch from crisis to crisis, which helps no one, but really affects a young, growing department like ours.
The other day, you were quoted in the press as having had an out-of-body experience. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, it was out-of-body because you get some of those in this kind of job, but this was particularly acute because I testified Wednesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the need for comprehensive immigration reform, and it was being hit really hard on resources at the border and border security. And the next day, I was before the Senate Appropriations Committee talking about the fact that we were going to lose the equivalent of 5,000 Border Patrol agents and that we were going to have to furlough port officers at our ports of entry. So, you know, trying to do both at the same time is really an impossible task.
Well, you referenced this in your speech, but certainly 10 years ago when the department was formed, cybersecurity was kind of one of the least talked about parts of the department. It was really kind of placed, put together by small entities that had been sitting around in the rest of the federal government. Obviously, it's becoming now one of the most important missions of the department. And how important is it to pass minimum standards for security equipment in critical infrastructure? And especially in light of the recent news about the Chinese, do you think that the bill you sent to Congress is going to have a second chance?
I hope so, because the executive order can only go so far. It's not only standards, it's information sharing. And it's sharing information early enough so that we can all get in there, find out what the intrusion is, and work to mitigate or minimize the harm, right? And to share knowledge about it so others can protect themselves. And it's protection of core critical infrastructure. We're not talking the small business. We're talking, you know, utilities, the banking system, the telecommunication system, the systems we all rely on. We can't mandate that. That would have to be done legislatively. We're going to try to do it with the voluntary adoption and sharing of standards. We will see how that goes. There are other areas in the cyber realm, Elaine, where only legislation will help. I'm always cautiously optimistic that perhaps this will come back up again.
Okay. The other thing that gets discussed a lot in the area of cybersecurity is sort of the relative place of DHS versus DOD. Mm-hmm. DOD has a cyber command. DOD has lots of money. And some people think that you guys are sort of the poor relative in that relationship. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you're negotiating that relationship?
Yeah, we have a very good, and what we've developed and is really what we call amongst ourselves, Director Mueller and General Alexander and myself, we call the Troika. We've really looked at roles, responsibility, and lanes in the role and the road for the federal government in the cyber realm. Because DOD is really for the international aspect of things, but a lot of cybersecurity, what we're talking about, is domestic. So we have to figure out how to manage that. Plus, a lot of the work is in the civilian capacity, not necessarily the military capacity. But we want to use the technology resources of the NSA. So how do you do that? Well, we have figured, I think, out a way to do it informally. One of the MOUs I signed early in my term was one with Bob Gates over at DOD, Secretary Gates, and it was about how we would embed people in each other's places, but also how we would share with appropriate restrictions the technological resources of the NSA into the domestic Homeland Security realm. With the FBI, we've been working on what is the split between prevention and protecting of core critical infrastructure and managing systems in the event and as attacks occur. I don't want to say in the event because they're occurring even now and they occur all the time. But also the investigation and attribution and, if possible, prosecution. So, I think that working together, we have lighted upon a realistic and workable solution to how we organize within the federal government the best way to deal with cyber.
Changing venues for a minute, I want to go to FEMA and emergency response. After Katrina, a lot of people said FEMA had been substantially weakened by being placed in DHS. And in fact, there was some, for those of us who've paid attention to this over the decade, there's a lot of chatter for a while about taking FEMA out of DHS. That
right.
seems to have gone away. And so I wanted to ask you, what do you think has happened to blunt that initiative?
Performance. I think it has been recruiting some really great leadership at FEMA who are experienced professionals in the field. I think it's been giving them greater discretion to move quickly. It's been the president's willingness to execute things like pre-landfall disaster declarations so that you can begin preparation even before a storm hits. It's been accelerating the federal government's response, the disaster declaration process and the like, so states know what kind of finances they have available to draw upon. It's been greater use of assets like the National Guard in appropriate circumstances. But we've also seen within the DHS family that when you have a major disaster, I'll use Sandy as an example. It was FEMA. It was the Coast Guard who led the search and rescue mission. It was TSA and CBP all had roles to play. And we had actually created within the entire DHS a surge force of people who are not FEMA employees but had gone through some rudimentary training. And they deployed up to the New York, New Jersey area. We housed them on ships, merchant marine ships in New York Harbor. Not elegant housing, I might add. And they worked literally going home by home, apartment by apartment. They helped staff the disaster recovery centers and the like. They were a big force multiplier for us. So we saw how within DHS, using all its components and the outreach we have, it just allows you to better manage a big disaster.
Great, and that was actually took care of one of the other questions I was going to ask, which was about Sandy mm-hmm. and what you thought worked particularly well there.
I thought we were able to really massive resources quickly. I mean, within a few days, we had 18,000 people working Sandy, and they were working day and night, and they worked for weeks, and they worked through Thanksgiving because the survivors, you know, they were really, it was, and it still is, very destructive and real impacts being felt. I think that went well, and I think the governors and the mayors who were involved really worked closely with us and we with them, and it was a good partnership. Now we're working through some issues about flood insurance and those kinds mm-hmm. of things, and we're looking at ways we can accelerate that process because, you know, in the end, people and businesses need to know what their losses are, what they're going to recoup by insurance, so they can make decisions about rebuilding.
Okay. Last time the immigration reform was on the national agenda, there was a great deal of skepticism about the government's ability to do anything at the border. Yeah. And that was a common thread in the debate. Under the Obama administration, the situation at the border seems to improve dramatically. Some people will argue that this has nothing to do with you all and has to do with demographic changes that are going on in Mexico and an improvement in the economy in Mexico. Can you talk about the relative importance of these two factors, what you're actually doing at the border, and then what's happening in Mexico to perhaps change the situation?
I think it's a little of both. There is no question that the border, from a security standpoint, is stronger than it's ever been. And the Congress has helped. It's one area where they've actually been appropriating the money to do the job. So you have more boots on the ground, air cover, as I mentioned. We call it boots in the air, technology and the like. You're never going to seal that border. I mean, it's a big, complicated border. And some areas are incredibly hard to cross, even by foot or horseback. So it's, you know, the notion that you're just going to wall off the border or something of that sort is a pipe dream. Nonetheless, the security is there. And really, the economic situation in Mexico is better. Our partnerships with Mexico are better. But we still have illegal immigration. We have the narco traffickers, the human smugglers, and the like. Those are who we really want to focus on. The suggestion I am making and what I am suggesting to you and to the Congress is you can add some more Border Patrol agents or another mile of fence or what have you, but really you need to look at immigration as a system of which the border is a part. And if you really want to help border security at this point, you need to focus on what's going on, what's creating the demand, right? And that's why you need a national system for dealing with employers. You need to deal with, you know, some of these limitations on legal migration so that more people can come legally into our country, contribute their talents and energies, come through our ports. We have their biometrics. We know who they are. And then we need to bring those illegally in the country out of the shadows again, so we know who they are. We can run their background checks, and they can begin a process of through fines and penalties, learning English, paying taxes, and all the rest, getting right with the law. And you know, when you look at the system that way, that actually strengthens what we do at the border.
You know, growing up mostly in border states, as you corrected me, what insights, I mean, long before you came to this job, right, what insights did you have from being on the border that maybe the rest of us who grew up in places that were far away from the border, what insights did you have that you brought to the job?
Well, I think, you know, I think a greater recognition that some of the bumper sticker solutions were not really workable. I think a realization of, you know, the need for legal migration to keep contributing to our economic vitality and growth, to the labor that we need to support our businesses. I mean, it's really interesting to hear business after business come into Washington and say they can't find workers. And then you say, well, you know, how about helping on some immigration reform and whatever. So, but now they're pretty much speaking with one voice, and the faith-based community is speaking with one voice, and the advocacy groups are speaking with an ever stronger voice, and you see this all now coming together. And like I said, we're very supportive and hopeful that the Congress will be able to take this up.
We had a little bit more specific question from the audience, from Jason, about the status of trying to get a solid exit system for visa holders and visitors. What's going on there?
Yeah. One of the things we've been able to do over the past several years is really create what we call an enhanced biographic system, uniting many, many different data sets that we have in a way that allows us to run literally millions of names daily through it. That enhanced biographic gives us a much greater sense of who's in the country, but more importantly, who's leaving the country. Now, the question always raised is, why don't you do a biometric exit, you know, where everybody goes through and you put your hands down, or you do an iris check or something of that sort. And here's the deal with that. I think we would like to move toward that over time. Our airports in particular were not built with exit lanes in mind. I mean, just architecturally. So that's a big deal. And the technology at this point, technology always becomes cheaper over time, but at this point it's extraordinarily expensive. And I haven't seen anybody in Washington throwing money at anything recently. So, but I will tell you that our plan, and we've given it to Congress, is we've already been implementing this enhanced biographic exit. We've also gone back and cleaned up a lot of the so-called visa overstay population and been able to reprioritize that in terms of removal. And between those efforts and what we're actually doing at the borders and the ports, I think we have a much better handle on who's actually in the country. Is it 100%? Is it perfect? No. We have a huge country, large borders, with the most open society in the world. But I think within the context of that, we have made significant progress, and we continue to work the problem.
And how about on the Canadian border? You know, we talk so much about the border with Mexico, but how about on the Canadian border? I mean, I remember when the department was stood up, there was a lot of criticism of Canada for their open immigration policies and coming across our border. What's your relationship like with the Canadian government now and the border there?
Well, it was excellent until I beat my Canadian counterpart in a curling match. beyond that, the President and Prime Minister Harper signed something called the Beyond the Border Initiative. It includes really managing that border as a 21st century border, technology, aerial coverage. It's a big, long border, very sparsely populated, working to see if we can agree on issues that allow us to pre-inspect cargo and people before they get to the actual border. We're working on those agreements right now. You know, ironically, sequester will be felt up there because there's only a few big crossing places for trade on the Canadian-U.S. border, and they're really important crossing places. In fact, trade-wise, they're probably the number one or two crossing places, not just between the U.S. and Canada, but in the world. As sequester evolves and as we have to furlough people who are port officers and not fill vacant positions and not pay overtime, we're unfortunately going to see those lines really stretch.
Okay. And finally, at a recent hearing on your department, researchers at the Congressional Research Service pointed out that 30 other agencies, in addition to DHS, have Homeland Security in their missions. And they were critical that there was no consistent federal definition of Homeland Security. Does this matter?
Well, probably be nice, but does it really matter in practice? I'm not sure. That's the first time I've even heard that, and I've been the secretary 4+ years, so it's really not affecting my day-to-day work. But here's the thing. Under Homeland Security Presidential Directive 5, HSPD 5, I mean, there's really a clear outlining of when you have a big, complicated event, what is the role of DHS? And BP is a good example of this, which is to coordinate and lead multiple agencies who are responding. And there it was the EPA and Energy and Interior, just to name a few. And we actually, for months after the spill, at a cabinet level, the secretaries and the administrators would get twice daily or once daily on the phone, weekends, all, it didn't matter, going through what everyone was doing, what the response was, what some of the big issues were, and that really helped coordinate the response. And I think, you know, in the aftermath, looking back, again, you always learn lessons, always things you would do better or differently. But in the context of the largest oil spill of its type, I think really worked well to help mitigate the damage. And we did that after Sandy as well. So in practice, what we mean by Homeland Security is what I said. It's agility. It is the ability to prevent as well as protect. It's the ability to continue to innovate. That's what we consider to be Homeland Security. And lastly, it is a sense that it is not the responsibility of one government department. It's not the responsibility solely of the federal government. You have the states that have a critical responsibility. Governor O'Malley's here. Cities have a responsibility. And every single person has a responsibility in the security realm for the safety of themselves, but also of each other. So trying to, in DHS 3.0, inculcate that and just make it, this is one of the things we do, like putting on a seatbelt, will be important for us.
Anyway, finally, we have a student in the audience, Zach, who wants to know, I'll read his question exactly, as a student, what advice do you have for those who are interested in public service?
Do it. It is a wonderful, rewarding way to spend your work life. You can work with some of the most wonderful, talented people around. At a place like DHS, what I have found, and one of the delightful things I found, when I didn't know what to expect when I came in, I got to tell you, it's a big transition going from the governor of Arizona, where it was 75 degrees and giving my state of the state, to the very next day being in Washington, D.C., and it was like 16. And going into this department, which doesn't, you know, we're kind of scattered around Washington, D.C., and I just didn't know what to expect. What I have found is that the men and women in the department, and I give a special credit to those who came in the first wave, are very committed to mission. And one of the things I would like to do is work with them to give them a sense of empowerment and encouragement to do the work they do. And for students, I would say, if you want a place where you can build a terrific career, where we really want our employees to stay with us and to work in this field, it's just a great way to do it. So see me after class.
On behalf of Brookings Governance Studies and the new initiative on leadership and management, I want to thank the Secretary for her words today, for all the insights she's given, and for her terrific management of a very important piece of the U.S. government.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.